From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The vetting and the speculation are over. Now the politicking and predictions kick in. With Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, Americans get a real-time refresher course on how a judge gets to the Supreme Court. But do you know how cases get there? Fred Smith is here to talk us through that process in English. Right, Fred?
Absolutely. I'll do my best.
He's associate professor of law at Emory. So, Fred, first, a little reminder here. How the Supreme Court fits into the three branches of government.
Sure. Right. So the Supreme Court is, of course, the head of the judicial branch. Right. So the president's the head of the executive, Congress. And that is, so that would be the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader would be the head of the legislative branch. And the Supreme Court is the head of the judiciary. And beneath them is another level of Court of Appeals. That's where Judge Kavanaugh, for example, is at this moment. And just below that is the trial court level, which are called federal district courts.
All right. So let's actually follow a case through that, like
sure.
a trial court. I wanted to pick a case that was from Georgia, Foster versus Chatman.
Sure.
All right. So first, a little bit on this case.
Yeah. So absolutely. So some cases get to the Supreme Court through the state system, right? That is, someone goes to a state trial court, and then they go to a state court of appeals or the state Supreme Court, and then they go to the United States Supreme Court. The case of Foster versus Chatman got to the Supreme Court that way.
Okay. So somebody went through a state court system, did not like the verdict, so appealed it.
That's exactly right. So in his particular circumstances, he was convicted, he was sentenced to death, and later there was evidence that his jury was selected with racial bias. That is, that the prosecutor had intentionally gotten rid of every black potential juror, wrote the word B by all of the jurors, black jurors, circled them, highlighted them, wrote words like no black and no black church. And so that evidence later came to light. The Georgia Supreme Court declined to hear his case, but the United States Supreme Court saw that record, was overwhelmed by it, and decided to grant what's called certiorari, which means that they will hear the case.
Okay, so the Georgia Supreme Court, the lawyers or legal team said, please hear this case. The Georgia Supreme Court said no. So then how does it get to the Supreme Court?
Right, so then what happens is someone files, in this case, Mr. Foster and his lawyers file what's called a petition for certiorari, which is just a fancy way of saying, a brief that says, please hear my case. And there are about 8,000 of those every year that are filed.
Wow.
Yeah. And only about 80 are granted. And so in his particular circumstances, he was one of those 8,000 initial petitions. And then he was one of the 80 or so that the Supreme Court decided to grant that year.
So how do they decide on which 80 cases to hear in a given year?
Sure. There are couple of ways that that can happen, or maybe three. So the most common way is that courts of appeals are divided, right? So one court has said that the law is A, another court has said that the law is B. Sometimes you can get really fancy with it, and another court has said that the law is C, and the court wants to resolve that issue. That's the vast majority of cases that the court grants. Another set of circumstances, though, is issues of tremendous national importance, right? So there may be some circumstances in which there needs to be clarity about what the law is.
So that's why the Supreme Court took on the travel ban, the Muslim travel ban.
The travel ban case is a really good example of that. That circumstance. And then in death penalty cases, the court is more willing than it is in other types of cases to step in just when it sees a clear error of law, even if there is no split, because of the stakes, namely, someone's life is in their hands. And in that case, I believe the seven justices concluded that this was a violation of the 14th Amendment. And there was only one dissent, because at the time, Justice Scalia was not on the court.
But not all death penalty cases make it to the Supreme Court.
That's right. They're just more likely to in the event of an egregious legal error.
How about the case when there was a water dispute between Florida and Georgia, one of the cases that was heard just last month?
Sure, right? So now we're getting really in the weeds, which is great.
I don't know how weedsy
get. Well, no, but this is fun, though, because, this is, I'm a Fed courts professor, so this kind of thing gets me excited. So another way that a case can get to the Supreme Court, and this is quite rare. rare. And that's what's called the court's original jurisdiction. So there are a handful of circumstances in which someone doesn't actually even have to initially file in a trial court and make its way through the entire system. They can go directly to the United States Supreme Court. And the most common circumstance where that's true is when one state is suing another state. When that happens, they don't need to go through all of the other procedural barriers. They can go directly to the Supreme Court and say, you know, in this case, Florida suing the state of Georgia over, of course, a waters dispute.
All right. So let's go back to these 80 cases that are heard each year. We don't hear about all of these. We just hear
Probably
about
not.
What the big social issues, that's, you know, the gay marriage, the refusing to bake a cake, that kind of thing.
That's right.
What are all the other cases?
They're cases where the courts of appeals are divided. And they tend to be important issues. Certainly to the parties, and perhaps in many circumstances beyond that, important for questions of justice, important for questions related to business and the economy. But they're not hot button issues, and often there is tremendous agreement among the justices in those particular cases. So we hear about the cases that divide 5-4 and the like. But my term, for example, when I clerked there for Justice Sotomayor, I think most cases were unanimous. And the question really was, it was more important that there be a clear answer than there be a right answer, in the sense that different courts had reached different conclusions. There were very well-reasoned, thought-out reasons for lots of different rulings of law. But the important thing was that there be clarity, and that's often what those cases were. So they weren't always the most exciting cases from the perspective of the news and the like, but for the litigants or for the businesses or for the criminal defendant. Or for the person who's languishing in prison, or for the people who are languishing in prison, those cases are important.
Well, we hear an awful lot about how Supreme Court justices get to the court, but we're hearing a little bit about how cases actually get to the Supreme Court with Fred Smith. He's Associate Professor of Law at Emory University. Okay, let's go back to that kind of process. They get 8,000 appeals, petitions, or what was the word?
Petitions for certiorari.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So they get those petitions. How do they make a decision on which cases actually get heard?
Yeah. So again, the most important factor generally is that there is a split of opinion.
Right.
That's really where the action is.
Yeah, I got that. But how about do they read through
the mechanics of the process? So the question sort of is, do the justices take a pile of 8,000 petitions and sort through them? The answer is almost.
Wow, so, that's impressive.
So what ends up happening actually is that for most of the justices, I believe at this point it's still 7 justices, they participate in what's called the cert pool. And what that means is that one clerk for one of those 7 justices will read the petition and will write a short memo about that petition. So they'll describe the facts, they'll describe the law, they'll describe any split of opinion among the lower courts, and they'll make a recommendation about whether to take that case. The recommendation isn't the important thing, especially because the clerks almost always recommend deny. The important thing is whether or not there in fact is a deeply rooted split of opinion on an important legal issue. And so the justices take a look at that. And so they all certainly read that memo. It's kind of harder to read every petition.
Right.
They may go back and pull the petition if they need to, if there's something that, but typically the action at that point is in the much, much, much shorter memo that one of the clerks has written.
That puts a lot of power in the hands of the clerks, doesn't it?
In some sense. All right. So
In their interpretation, maybe. That's
sure, I'll give you that. I mean, I hesitate about the word power, right? Because they're not, the clerks at no moment are the ones making the decision. And again, their recommendation isn't the important thing. But sure, I mean, there is a level of trust that's put in the clerk. That they're going to be reading the petition thoughtfully and carefully. That also might put some importance on the 2 justices who are not in the cert pool, right? Because there is at least then some accountability to the extent that Someone who's not in the cert pool says, actually, that I read that petition and I read it differently. And I actually think that we should hear this case. And here's why. So that might be an additional check as well.
And then the cases are argued in front of the court.
That's right.
That's an interesting dynamic, the conversations that happen in between, the questions that they are asking the lawyers.
Sure.
It's often interpreted that they're not really talking to the lawyers, they're talking to each other. Is that accurate?
I think that that's accurate. I think that most of the questions that are asked have very little to do with the lawyer who's in front of them and has much more to do with persuading their colleagues. And the reason for that is that the justices don't talk about these cases nearly as much as you might think they do. As a matter of fact, they have almost certainly not talked about the case at all. By the time it gets to oral argument, the only conversation they've had about it is whether to grant the case. And so it's the first opportunity to kind of highlight the key arguments from the perspective of the justices, for them to kind of telegraph where they stand, what makes them persuadable. And of course, the dynamic in recent years has been that once Justice Kennedy speaks, most of the questions were basically new iterations of Justice Kennedy's question, because it showed what he cared about. And so on controversial questions, the justices would sort of try to figure out a way to convince him in particular.
Well, that's going to change.
That is about to change.
And then they all go and sit in a chamber and talk together?
That's what they do next, exactly, right? So either that day or the next day, they sit around a big conference table and they go around in order of seniority, with accepting the chief. The chief begins. The chief is always the most senior, even if they're not technically the most senior. And then they go around the table and they say, here is how I intend to vote, and here's why I intend to vote that way. They're not really, even at that moment, it's not deliberative. They're not interjecting and saying,
right.
Well,
they're not saying, but how about this?
Exactly.
And he said that.
They're literally just saying, here's how I intend to vote, and here's why. And then of the majority, whoever's the most senior member of the majority, again, with the exception being the chief is always the most senior, they select who writes the majority opinion, and then among the dissenting judges or justices, the most senior dissenting justice decides who writes the dissenting opinion.
So this is a branch of government that, you know, is cloaked in a sense of secrecy, even though we get reporting on it. What do you think, Fred, people misunderstand about the court, or what you'd like them to know?
I would like them to know that I think that what makes the court work, and this is what I came away with when I clerked there, is that all of the justices have deep respect for each other's intellect and each other's integrity. They may deeply disagree about the law. They might deeply disagree about what justice requires. But they always respect each other's intellect and integrity. And that's why it functions as well as it does.
Thank you so much for bringing us through that.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's
Fred
a pleasure
Smith,
to be here.
He's Associate Professor of Law at Emory. Now, just ahead, we're going to talk about another great American institution, high school football. But first, more than 9 million American adults vape regularly. We're going to find out why. This is On Second Thought.
There I was completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating as I drift from town to town. Feel as though nobody cares if I live or die. So I might as well begin to put some action in my life. Breaking the law.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. E-cigarettes hit the market as an aid to quit smoking. Now, the CDC reports that more than 9 million American adults vape regularly, and a new Georgia State University report finds that a year into vaping, 90% of people continue to smoke traditional cigarettes. Public health advocates are also concerned that juuling is on the rise among high school and college students. Juul is a brand of e-cigs that some advocate and fear could be an on-ramp to nicotine addiction. We're going to talk today about this study with Michael Erickson Dean from the School of Public Health at Georgia State, which conducted the study. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also on the line is Amy Barkley. She's a regional advocate for the Tobacco-Free Kids campaign. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, Virginia.
Now, the first electronic cigarette came onto the United States market 2007 about, and here's Catherine Hagel on the David Letterman show explaining to him what a vape pen is.
Wait a minute, what was that?
It's water vapor.
Really?
I'm essentially humidifying the space.
Is that how it works, Michael? Water vapor?
Well, hardly. The most important thing to understand is that these products, these e-cigarettes, are safer than smoking, but they're not safe in their own right. They do have hazards and risks associated with them, but it's better to use them than to smoke.
So they were originally marketed as a tool for quitting. What did your study find?
Well, technically, they can't be marketed that way by the FDA requires evidence to show that they're actually effective to be marketed as a smoking cessation device. But what our study showed, and we were quite surprised by it, is that people who were smoking and vaping a year ago, after a year of that, 90% were still smoking. Some of them gave up vaping. Some of them continued to vape and smoke, but the vast majority were still smoking, which is not the goal of e-cigarettes. It's really to help people quit smoking. But part of the problem is that can't be advertised or stated because it would be a type of health claim.
So there are FDA regulations for vape cigarettes or e-cigarettes?
They're in the works. When the law was passed in 2009, giving FDA authority to regulate tobacco products, e-cigarettes didn't exist basically and were not included by name in the law. So FDA had to obtain authority to regulate e-cigarettes, and that was called deeming. They got the deeming authority from the government to do e-cigarettes, and they are in the process now of regulating these products. And companies are asking for permission to make health claims, but they have not been forthcoming yet from the FDA.
Okay. So there have been some studies, however. A 2015 study by Harvard talked about e-cigarettes having a link to popcorn lung. This has been challenged. What's the thinking on this now? And what exactly is popcorn lung?
Popcorn lung is actually a condition that's associated with workers in plants that make packaged popcorn that you put in the microwave, and that there's a certain chemical in that process, then the workers were exposed to that industrially at the manufacturing line, and they got a lung disorder from it. There have been some concerns that chemical has been seen in e-cigarettes, but that's one of the red herrings, so to speak, that there are rare events that are picked up, and then it scares people away from trying e-cigarettes. But it also, people need to remember they are not safe. They do have risks. Popcorn lung isn't one of the major risks, but it is gets across the idea that people need to be cognizant, but the real goal being to quit smoking, however that can be done.
So, Amy, vaping marketed as a tool for quitting smoking. We're hearing from Michael that study says that 90% of people keep up with both. But is that why people are picking up? Do you have a sense? Picking up vapes, rather?
Well, I do think that people perceive, you know, that they are safer. And as Dr. Erickson has pointed out, they are less harmful than cigarette smoke. But certainly, currently, even though the FDA, as Dr. Erickson pointed out, has the authority and to regulate e-cigarettes and has deemed them tobacco products, so they should be being regulated as other tobacco products are, they've actually delayed implementation of some of the rules. So there are a lot of products, including Juul, out on the market that really shouldn't be on the market under current FDA rules. They really aren't supposed to be marketing products that haven't been subject to some kind of review by FDA, new products that aren't substantially equivalent to products that are already out there on the market. So I think people do think it's safer. I do think it's very disturbing, the study that that Dr. Erickson and others did at Georgia State, that people aren't quitting necessarily in many cases. So I think it is that people want to possibly try something safer, but then often it's because people want to sort of evade the smoke-free laws that we have all over the country. You can't really smoke cigarettes in many places, workplaces and public places, but some states and cities have not caught up with the e-cigarette trend, and so e-cigarette use is allowed indoors in some places.
Well,
so
I've also seen it, you know, outdoors, like walking by a cafe, sure. You know, like clouds, big puffs of smoke coming out. But this term, juuling, I want to capitalize on that or talk about that because it is J-U-U-L. This has recently become really popular among college and high school campuses. So what do the juuls look like, Amy?
Well, they look exactly like a flash drive. They're a little bit longer than a typical flash drive. They are charged. They have a little USB port and can be charged on your computer. So it took a long time, actually, for parents and teachers and schools to recognize that it really was an e-cigarette because it looks very much like just a regular flash drive. And they even have skins that are available, sort of like you put on your cell phone and other devices, you know, with it's like a sticker that you put on it. And so it looks sort of fun and just like a flash drive. So this is a product that is especially concerning because it can be used in school without detection. Now, the schools are finally kind of getting wise to this and sending out advisories to parents and so forth, but, you know, just now. And the really frightening thing about this particular product is that in a pretty short period of time, they now represent as much as 70% of the e-cigarette market. So it is an enormously popular brand. I think it was introduced in 2015, but really in the past 6 months or so, it's gotten extremely popular. And they are a little bit more expensive. The starter kit is around $50, which you may think is out of reach of some kids. But I was just with some of our youth advocates in Washington, D.C. this week, and they were telling me about how kids will pool their money to buy a Juul device and the starter kit and the little pods, which contain flavors. I should point that out. That's important. They come in mango and creme brulee and fruit medley and things like that that are appealing to kids. And they will pool their resources so they can share them, and then they will sell hits of the Juul to their friends, you know, say $1 or $2 for a hit to recoup their costs. So there's a little cottage industry going on there.
Michael, why do you think these are so much more popular than the e-cigs we've seen in recent years? Is that she's talking about the portability, the flavor?
I think we're trying to figure out why it's become such a huge success. As Amy said, it's a multi-billion dollar company already. It's taken over half the market share for e-cigarettes. Part of it is it delivers nicotine much more quickly than existing products, and it resembles a cigarette in terms of its nicotine delivery profile more than any other ENDS electronic product. It really looks like smoking. And it's also can be used secretly. You can hide it in your hand, and it's become very vogue for kids in high school to show them using ENDS surreptitiously without their teachers knowing about it. So it's a combination of being sleek, technological, but you can't overlook the fact that it's delivering nicotine just like smoking, when none of the other e-cigarette products do that.
How much nicotine?
Too much nicotine, and that's the other problem. In fact, just yesterday, the company Juul announced that they were going to be offering products with reduced nicotine. Right now, a Juul pod has nicotine that's equivalent to a pack of cigarettes.
So how many, like, puffs or hits could there be?
About 200.
About 200 on a Juul pod.
This is so new, we really don't know how many hits or puffs kids or adults are taking a day, but it could well be that their nicotine exposure is higher than if they were smoking, if they used it more. The other thing to note with this is that this is the first company that's used what it's called nicotine salts as opposed to liquid nicotine. It's a different chemical structure, and it's thought that the salts, nicotine in the salt form, is more easily absorbable in the blood and gets to the brain more quickly than nicotine in a liquid form.
But that points to some of the things I've read about kids saying that they start juuling and they just can't stop. Does that quick delivery to the brain make it more addictive?
Yes, and that's why cigarettes. I mean, if you go back in time and look at the uptake in smoking among teenagers in the 70s and 80s, it was really a very few cigarettes would get someone addicted. We had kids in our surveys that we did when I was at CDC that were addicted to smoking before they graduated from high school and wanted to quit at that age. And Juul has that power to be very addicting. The company, of course, doesn't want kids to use it because it gives them a bad reputation. They would like to see it used by smokers to have them quit, but that's, as far as we can tell, not happening to the extent we'd like to see.
That's Dr. Michael Erickson. He's Dean of Public Health at Georgia State University, spearheaded a recent study about addiction rates of e-cigarettes. Also joining us is Amy Barkley. She's a regional advocate for the Tobacco-Free Kids campaign. Well, Amy, I'm thinking that, you know, for years, public health advocates have been working on getting kids to not smoke or not even pick up in the first place from an early age. What do you think this Juuling is doing to that effort?
Well, it is alarming because I know some state surveys have shown that, well, number one, in many states and nationally, the numbers show us that more kids are using e-cigarettes than smoking. You know, we've made some pretty good progress on reducing youth smoking over the past couple decades. And, you know, we continue to have slow and steady progress there with smoking rates continuing to go down. But at the same time, the rates of e-cigarettes are going up. So more kids are using e-cigarettes than smoking now. And as Dr. Erickson pointed out, you know, this is a very powerful, Juul in particular, but, you know, there are many different products out there that deliver nicotine pretty effectively. And we've learned that some of the kids that are using e-cigarettes are kids that say they would have never started smoking. So they look at e-cigarette use differently. And often they don't even really understand that it's a tobacco product. They say, well, there's no tobacco in here. But then they, you know, primarily nicotine comes from tobacco. But so they don't really see it the same way. And because of the marketing and because of, you know, the cool sleek technological appeal of things like Juul and the groovy looking pens and all the different flavors, you know, they're using these things thinking that it's not as bad as smoking and they're not smoking. But then once they become addicted to nicotine, we don't really know what'll happen. You know, they may turn to regular cigarettes when they have the opportunity.
Well, people like Catherine Hagel, you know, on Instagram, right. There are all these celebrities with their vaping, various different vaping machines. But how do minors get them? They don't sell them. I've seen them at storefronts, but they can't sell cigarettes to someone under 18. Can they sell Juuls?
No. The FDA requires that you have to be 18 in order to buy them or be sold them. But they are available online, and all you have to do is click a box and say that you're 18. I think a lot of retailers don't really understand the device themselves and, you know, maybe unwittingly selling them. So kids are, I know there have been some studies that have shown that over half of the kids that have bought e-cigarettes buy them from a retail store, and then another third say they also get them from social sources. So they really are very readily available. The FDA said a couple months ago that they were going to take steps to, you know, step up enforcement and do more education of retailers to make sure they're not being sold to kids, but they really need to take further action. They really need to remove the flavors, certainly, from the market. And they have the ability to do that, but they aren't doing it yet. So we've called on them to step up their action on e-cigarettes, particularly in the wake of the Juul epidemic.
But I remember, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s, clove cigarettes became kind of a thing. You know, it wasn't the regular cigarette. It was a little more sophisticated, a little different flavor. But the Obama administration actually pushed for a ban against them and menthol cigarettes, I believe. Whatever happened to that? Have those been repealed?
Well, the administration, the government banned all flavors from cigarettes except for menthol. So menthol is still available everywhere in the country, except now in San Francisco, which passed a local ordinance banning flavors of any type, including menthol, from tobacco products. So the issue with flavors is complicated. It's different around the country. Cigarettes can only be mentholated as the only flavor. But electronic cigarettes and cigarillos and little cigars, they still can have flavors. And so FDA is currently collecting data from public input as to what they should do about flavors and whether flavors have any utility in helping people quit smoking, which hasn't been shown yet. The evidence suggests that they're attractive, particularly to kids.
Yeah, clearly in your study, that also showed that people who may have picked these up to quit are not quitting. But would you advocate for e-cigarettes to be off the market, for example?
Yeah, the thing that's so interesting about our study is showing that smokers need to avoid dual use. They're continuing to smoke and using e-cigarettes at the same time. And when you do that, you don't stop smoking. You continue to smoke. And our data and other data are showing that 80 to 90% of dual users continue to smoke. People need to quit smoking. And if electronic cigarettes can help them do that, that's great. But they shouldn't do both.
Michael Erickson, he is Dean of Public Health at Georgia State University. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And also Amy Barkley, Regional Advocate for the Tobacco-Free Kids Campaign. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Virginia.
Now, I'm a fellow with a heart of gold, with the ways of a gentleman, I've been told, the kind of a fellow that wouldn't even harm a flea. But if me and a certain character met, the guy that invented the cigarette, I'd...
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. You ready for some high school football?
Clear eyes, full hearts, kid knows.
That one was for you, coach.
All right, baby. All right.
While we're here in the air conditioning, students are already out on the field practicing, and the season is around the corner, and GPB Sports is back with Friday night footballs in Georgia this fall. But before the team hits the gridiron, we're going to be meeting with some of the people who are going to be bringing you updates and coverage this morning. John Nelson from GPB Sports host, he's joining me in the studio. John, thank you for being here.
Anytime.
You guys knew every single word to that montage, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Matt Stewart's also here. He is the play-by-play commentator for the show. Matt, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So we're seeing some new faces on your team this year. Who's on your sports team?
Well, let's see. We've got Chelsea Tafoya, who's coming in to work some hosting, doing sidelines and fan stuff in the games. And you're going to be joined by somebody who's, I think, what, at Two Sports Star on the Twitters?
He is. Two Sportsmen.
Two Sportsmen.
Yeah, Brian Jordan. Of course, Atlanta sports fans know Brian Jordan very well. Two Sports Star, played in the NFL with the Atlanta Falcons and then went to Major League Baseball, ended up with the Atlanta Braves, played with the Cardinals and the Dodgers, and still lives here in Atlanta, has kids in high school in Atlanta.
Star of Young and the Restless.
Yeah, and I'll really be looking forward to working with Brian again. I've worked with him in the past on college football and college baseball events, and so looking forward to working with Brian on GPB this year.
And some familiar faces as well.
With Sam. Sam Crenshaw on the sidelines, and we're going to have Tommy Palmer back this year with everything Nat Line and below, I think, is probably his bailiwick's going to be, right?
Yeah, you know, Tommy knows everything about South Georgia football, and he's got that angle covered for us as well. And, you know, Sam, like most of us, has been covering high school football here in the state of Georgia, in the city of Atlanta for over two decades, and so bring his experience to the sideline, too. Real bonus to the team.
Yep.
So a lot of street cred and a lot of people on that team. How are you prepping for this season?
Well, there is no off season, really. I mean, yeah. Matt, it's 38-370, I think, is the way it is right now with high school football around the country. And, you know, it's fun to be able to sit there. And what I've always maintained is that the four seasons are not summer, fall, winter, and spring. It's football, spring football, Cruton, and National Signing Day.
Right. Right. No, yeah, you're right. And right now, the real phenomenon that's developed over the last decade has been the 7-on-7s. And those are passing camps and teams, 7-on-7s. It doesn't involve the linemen, more just the skill players and defensive backs and linebackers, stuff like that. But they go to camps basically the entire summer. I was out at one at Roswell Park here in the Corky Kell 7-on-7. Had 32 teams involved. Colquitt County was there. Lee County was there. And a lot of Atlanta area schools. But basically, these teams just hopscotch around the southeast, going from camp to camp to camp to camp. And it's now become kind of a daily and weekly ritual for all these teams to be involved in these 7-on-7. So football really never stops.
And you guys are following that throughout the year as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you have to keep your head on a swivel. Coaches always tell their players to keep their head on a swivel so they know what's coming. So do we these days. And like I said, it's It really is 370 days a year now.
Well, John, you blogged about Football Fridays on GPB's website and talked about the offseason and turnover involving coaches, which you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Where are they going to start their new jobs? What are these rates looking like now?
Well, this year, I think it was, 85 coaches. And I think last year it was 25% more than that. We're talking like almost 110, 120 coaches last year. And really, it's, I think, Matt, what, about 18 to 22% usual turnover for 400 schools here in the state. And this year it was more normal. And yes, I just used air quotes early on a Friday morning when it comes to that number. It's usually below 100. Last year it was atypically over 100. But yeah, we always have about 80 coaching changes.
Yeah, I saw your air quotes, so I knew what you meant. But hey, and it speaks to the competitiveness of high school football, the competitiveness in the coaching ranks as well. And the good coaches, the ones that are successful, get better jobs, and those who are not so successful cycle out or go to different jobs. But yeah, the turnover isn't because the job isn't good. The turnover is because the jobs are good.
Right. There's a lot of opportunity.
Exactly.
Well, there are 400 plus schools involved in the sport throughout Georgia High Schools Association. Which decisions are going to see new faces?
Wow. I mean, you've got, I mean, they're all over the place. You had a lot of coaches who have now cycled back through. You have, like a Ken Kofer, who coached down in South Georgia at Cook and took them to the playoffs for a really long time. He's now the new head coach at Wilcox County. Mm-hmm. Wesley Tankersley went from Ridgeland and took them deep into the playoffs. He's now the new head coach at Stevens County. And Frank Barton, who coached at Stevens County, is now in single A private. So really, there are times where if you did a flow chart and you went, you know, this guy went here, this guy took over here, this guy took over here, it really looks like a board where you're really making a whole bunch of circles. It's like a telestrator gone berserk some year.
Yeah, and I think what you see if you created that chart is you would see the flow going into Georgia, not so much out of Georgia. Coaches in states around the state of Georgia, Florida, Alabama, you know, as far as Virginia, those high school coaches, knowing the culture and the opportunities in this state, like to come to this state and be high school football coaches.
Well, football is not just a sport in the South. It's a big part of the culture, especially high school football. What do you think it is that keeps people loving their high school football?
Well, you remember high school football. I mean, it's just the whole atmosphere on, you know, Saturday night, and it just keeps, you know, keeps turning over because there's always new high school students that go there, and so new families are involved. But it's not just the families that are involved in the schools. Oftentimes, it's the communities as well. Sometimes people who don't even have, you know, students in the school anymore, their kids have grown up and moved on. They stay involved in the program, and then those alumni like to come back and be a part of, you know, the old school spirit. So it just keeps on circulating and growing and cycling itself with each passing class that graduates, and then they eventually come back and support.
And you think of it this way. If you're driving, if you're lost in the state of Georgia on a Friday night in the fall and you see lights in the distance, odds are that's a high school football game, and that way you can always go there, ask somebody where you are, get your bearings, and then go on your way. I mean, when you look at towns like a Fitzgerald, like a Homerville, like a, you know, it's all over the place. Like
Moultrie.
A Moultrie, definitely. Moultrie, when you have 10,000 people, when you have a Valdosta where you have two stadia where you could have 12 to 15 or 20,000 people at a particular game. It's just as important in an Americus or a Columbus or a Macon or a Warner Robins or a Leesburg or, you know, a Savannah or a Baxley or a Toccoa as it is in the bigger cities. And it's a source of pride for all of these people because after a Friday night game in Cedartown, you're going to go and have breakfast with all of your buddies in the surrounding towns on Saturday morning. And it's going to be, well, what did you do last night? Oh, we won. We beat so-and-so. We beat so-and-so. And so you've got to go to breakfast and you've got to be ready with what happened on Friday night, because if your team lost, you know your buddies are going to give you grief about it every single week. And if it's a rivalry, it's 52 weeks a year of all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I would say it's bigger in the smaller cities,
yes,
in the smaller towns. I mean, in the area of Atlanta where I live, there are five or maybe even six high schools within a 10-minute drive of where I live. So, you know, it's obviously a densely populated area, but the communities are more split there. You get into these towns like a Griffin, like a Moultrie, like, you know, just name it, Kingsland, Valdosta, go on and on and on. The community's not divided. They're pulling for one team, and that's the team. That's their team. That's their college, and that's their pro team playing on Friday night.
Yep.
Well, that is Matt Stewart, play-by-play commentator for GPB Sports. And also John Nelson is with us, a GPB Sports host. They're going to see some new faces on our Friday Night Football this year. And we're speaking about that season. For high school football updates, you can tune into GPB Sports on Friday, September 14th at 7 o'clock. Well, this is a big thing because GPB Sports is coming back on Friday night with football. So what are you looking forward to there?
Well, I'm looking forward to being back at the stadium. Last year, we were in studio on Friday nights, and then we went out to the stadiums during the playoffs. And as much as I enjoy, you know, John's company and Tommy's company and Sam's company in the studio, they're
it's not the same.
It's not the same. You're exactly right, Virginia. Not the same as being out there in the stadium, having the bands, you know, the fans, the cheerleaders, the popcorn, the hamburgers grilling, just the entire atmosphere that comes with Friday night football. It you can't be replicated in a studio. So I'm glad to be back at the stadiums.
Well, and if you are at the stadia all around the state of Georgia and following us, don't forget. Okay, now here's your blatant plug alert.
Okay.
Don't forget to download the GPB Sports app.
Yeah,
you can follow
right.
along everything with all your schedules, all your favorite teams, all that kind of stuff, because it's good for Android and iPhone, and I'm one of these Android guys, so it's right here as I'm flashing, which really works well for radio. I'm showing you something
air
on radio.
Air quotes flashing.
So, you know, right here. So I'm gonna hit a button, do my air quotes. GPB Football Sports app right mm-hmm. here. So download it and be a part of the process there on Facebook and Twitter. Like us, friend us, be a part of the conversation. There's your blatant promo for the show.
Well, we expected nothing less from
you,
John.
Go.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
But I want to go back to that urban-rural thing because I wonder if recruiters look at urban and rural players differently. I'm hearing a little bit about the chances of urban players outnumbering rural players and making it to the major leagues anyway.
Well, I mean, right now you're looking at Georgia as a top five state in the United States. When it comes to high school recruits, but you have recruiters from all around the country going to a Pickens County and going to the Dragons and picking up a running back like a Shannon Brooks who goes to play in Minnesota. You're seeing more recruiters coming in from the mid-major conferences, like the Mid-American Conference has really come in here the last couple of years and pulled a lot of kids out and gone, you know, and played in the Midwestern United States. And they'll be in Homerville looking at Clinch County, looking at a Tresman Marshall, just as much as they will be looking at a Dom Blaylock at a Walton, man.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, it's kind of like the NFL. They don't care how big or small the university are that you come from. They just care if you can play. And if you can play, you're going to get an opportunity. And that's the way it is in college football. It doesn't matter whether it's a small town or you're playing, you know, at Mill Creek High School, which I think is the largest high school in the entire state of Georgia. Case in point, most famous player to come out of Georgia, Herschel Walker, played at Johnson County High School, single-A school. And to make it current, you look at a couple of Georgia Bulldogs. Jake Fromm played at Houston County High School in Middle Georgia. Nick Chubb played at Cedartown High School. You don't have to be from a big town to make it big.
How about some of the concerns about players, high school players, especially during practices, hydration, head injuries? A survey by Harris Poll found that parents are limiting their children to sports like football because of concerns about CTE and other injuries. How are teams and programs tackling these kind of issues?
Well, in regard to hydration and conditioning in that matter, I think the Georgia High School Association and then just the National High School Association in general have done a really good job of recognizing this. This seemed to be a bigger problem in years past, but the structure of practices, how many times you can practice, how many water breaks are taken. We even have water breaks during the games early in the season when it's exceptionally hot. The other issue, of course, is the concussions, and that's a big issue, you know, not just at the high school level, but at every level. And one thing's that, you know, and that's an issue that's never going to go away, but I think that's also an issue that can be dealt with the education and teaching of proper tackling technique. And, you know, Pete Carroll of the Seattle Seahawks has kind of been at the forefront of this thing, teaching the rugby-type tackle where you're not leading with your head, you're leading with your shoulder, and then you're wrapping up around the waist and into the legs and dropping the player that way to try to cut down on the concussion problem.
How about another perennial question about high school sports, the relationship between academics and sports, especially 7A schools?
Well, with 7A schools and academics, you know, I think that you're looking at athletes who, and this is what you see universally, there are athletes who have tremendous grade point averages. I mean, like a Stetson Bennett, I'll give you an example from a couple of years ago. Stetson Bennett played at Pierce County High School down in Blackshear, Georgia, down in the southeast corner. And he's one of the most sought-after quarterbacks in the state. and he was going to pursue pharmacy. I think it was pharmacy or medical, something like that. So you're always going to have these athletes who are tremendously talented, not just on the field, but also up here between the ears. And you're seeing kids who are making sure that they're paying attention to both the books and what's going on the field.
Yeah, I don't have any numbers to back this up, but and I will commission John Nelson right now to do an exhaustive study across the board of every high school in the state of Georgia. But my guess is that with a football team, the GPA on average is probably greater than the general population because these kids are motivated. They have a reason to want to maintain their grade point average, not just to remain eligible to play for their high school, but also to keep themselves eligible should there be a college opportunity awaiting them beyond high school. So I would guess, and John, I'm commissioning you to do that study to find out. I believe that the GPA for football would be higher than the general population.
And then he'll make an app and he'll tell everybody about it.
Student athletes.
You guys are not just ready. I think you're champing at the bit for this, and I want to thank you so much for coming and joining us.
Kicking off August 14th with stuff on social media, September 14th outdoors.
Looking forward to it.
John Nelson from GBB Sports. He's the host, and Matt Stewart, play-by-play commentator for the show. GBB is going to be airing live Friday, September 14th. You heard it on GBB TV. Again, for more details, visit our website, gbbnews.org. And that is our show for today, but as always, we would love to hear from you. Earlier this month, we talked about Georgia's new hands-free law and the history of distracted driving. Neil from Myron had this to say.
I was calling to comment about the hands-free law they just enacted. I do hope that they enforce it vigorously. But another law I wish they would enforce just as vigorously is Georgia Motor Code 40-6-123. Failure to signal. That's a 3-point violation. And until Georgia motorists figure out what that little indicator lever is on the left side of the steering wheel, they have no right being in a car with a phone.
Thank you so much, Neil, for your voicemail. And you can listen to that earlier conversation on gpbnews.org. As always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or leave us a message at 404-500-9454. On Second Thought is produced by Summer Evans, Fenley Foxen, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our technical engineer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.